What is happening, gang? We have got a fun one for you today on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. In today's episode, we continue our time in Buffalo, and more specifically our time focused on building the Buffalo Bills. And in this episode, we kind of look at the second big event early in Bill Polian's days with the Bills, which was bringing Jim Kelly to Buffalo. This is the thing that really set into motion what would become one of the great dynasties in NFL history. It is a fascinating story, from sort of the rise and demise of the USFL to what it took to get Jim to Buffalo, the near miss the Bills had in 83 in getting him in, what actually transpired in the negotiation in 86 when Jim became available. I think we're actually going to make some news here. We got some never before heard stories related to the negotiation, some legendary stories. Kind of we get Bill's actual take on what happened. This is a fun one. Sit back, relax, and enjoy. This is Building the Bills, bringing Jim Kelly to Buffalo. All right, gang. Well, we've got a fun one for you today on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. We pick up today in the middle of our three-part Building the Bills trilogy. Just to recap kind of where we left off, you know, when we left off last, you know, Bill had ascended to general manager of the Bills, facing some sort of major consequential decisions, and that's kind of be the subject of today's episode as we dive into bringing Jim Kelly to Buffalo. You know, just remind everybody that 85 season, really difficult. You know, a coach you were really close to had been replaced. You know, things were changing in Buffalo, and it was a repeat of another 2-14 season. But things would be about to change, and the sort of dark cloud that would cover the lake would be lifted as Jim Kelly would begin the process of coming to Buffalo. So, Rick, why don't you kick us off this week?
Okay. So, let's take a step backward further in time and say, sort of set the scene. I think we need to look back to 1983, where there was an extraordinary group of players that were about to hit the pro football world in the 83 draft. Among them were John Elway, Eric Dickerson, Jimbo Covert, Bruce Matthew, Darryl Green, Dan Marino, the subject of today's show, Jim Kelly. Bill, what did you think of that draft?
Well, that may be one of the greatest drafts of all time in terms of, you know, Hall of Famers alone. And certainly from a quarterback perspective, it was an outstanding draft because you got three Hall of Famers there, Marino, Elway, and Kelly. And so it was, you know, it was just an outstanding amalgamation of talent. And it was interesting what roads they all took. Especially the quarterbacks, to finally reach their zenith in the NFL. Elway took a kind of a circuitous road by refusing to play in Baltimore and ended up getting himself traded to Denver. Marino, of course, went to the Dolphins, and Don Shula changed the entire offensive approach in the winking of an eye to accommodate his talent. And Jim Kelly, of course, went off to the USFL and made it back to Buffalo in a circuitous route, to say the least.
Yeah.
Well, I would be remiss in my house if I didn't ask this question. So before we kind of get into sort of Jim as the pro, and looking back at Jim as a collegian, you know, he was a dominant high school quarterback in the state of Pennsylvania, in East Brady, just outside of Pittsburgh. He was recruited by Joe Paterno at Penn State to not play quarterback, but to play linebacker. Paterno, obviously, as all of us Penn Staters know, went with Todd Blackledge. Kelly said, no thanks, went to Miami, and of course, was the sort of bane of Penn State's existence in college. And one of his first college starts led them to a 26-10 victory over Penn State. 2 years later, beat him again in the Orange Bowl. Bill, knowing how close you were to the Paternos, did you ever talk to them about Jim? What did they think of him as a player? And I sort of, I mean, Todd was great, but I mean, it would have been fun to have Jim as well. What did they ever regret that?
Yeah, the answer is yes. And Joe joked about it, and George joked about it a fair amount of time. But in reality, I think had Jim come to Penn State, he probably would have gotten an opportunity to challenge for the quarterback job, and I think without question would have won it. Joe, as anybody that follows Penn State football knows, had a philosophy which really didn't change until almost the end of his career, where, you know, aside from the quarterback, you take the next 11 best athletes and you put them on defense. And and Jim Kelly was among those, clearly. he could have been the next Jack Ham if he wanted to. And I think Joe saw it that way, actually. But fortunately for Jim, it didn't work out that way.
But that certainly speaks to how tough of a quarterback he was. He could have been a linebacker.
Without question.
Yep. So he was a four-year starter under quarterback guru Howard Schnellenberger. But it was a somewhat injury-plagued career at Miami, suffering a shoulder separation his senior year. He's commonly thought of as the first quarterback in what was later tagged QBU, that subsequently turned out quarterbacks with outstanding collegiate careers like Steve Walsh, Gino Toretta, and Ken Dorsey, and of course, pro stars, Bernie Kosar, and whether you call Vinny Testaverde a pro star or a pro journeyman, him also.
Miami under Howard Schellenberger was throwing the ball and using a pro approach much sooner than anybody else at the collegiate level, aside from LaValle Edwards at BYU. And so they were outliers in that regard. And Howard had been on Don Shula's staff at Miami. So he was well-versed in the pro passing game. And so they just attracted guys who could play that position. And in an era when the veer and option attacks and rollout attacks and things like that were the norm for the college level. So they had a jump on everybody else. And of course, the worm turned quickly with Elway at Stanford, Marino at Pitt. Now the so-called pro-style attack became the norm, but that was not the case when Howard first got to Miami.
Yep.
Rick, I'd be remiss if I didn't give you the ball for a few minutes. You had a little inside knowledge about the QBU in those days.
Yeah, so I was very good friends. In fact, almost merged our practices with a guy named Robert Fraley. Robert Fraley represented, among others, many of the head coaches in the NFL and some college coaches. He himself had been a quarterback at Alabama. He was behind Richard Todd, got injured, never quite had the career, but he went on to really be one of the early big-time agents among representing Bill Parcells, many others.
Joe Gibbs.
I'm trying to think. So anyway, Schnellenberger was among them. So this was Bernie Kosar's senior year, and you know, and he was just tearing things up. And I was staying with Fraley for the weekend, and he said to me, "Rick, I know you're not going to believe this, but Howard tells me he's got a kid on the bench who's actually more physically talented than Bernie." And I go, "Who that?" He goes, "It's a guy named Vinny Testaverde," and obviously, in terms of arm strength and so on, it was unbelievable. So, I mean, Howard, you know, amassed a group of people there that was incredible. Of course, sadly, Robert Fraley, in addition to being the agent for all those football coaches, was also Payne Stewart's agent, and along with Payne, died on that airplane when the oxygen level was cut off and it became a pilotless plane that was flying around. And it was really a major loss to the sports world, because Rhett was a terrific guy an honest guy and it affected a lot of lives very positively.
Well, that is a very sad segue into getting back to Jim, but we will do our best. So in getting back to Jim, Bill, what was your kind of evaluation of Jim coming out of college? Where did you see him ranked with the other famous prospects in that draft? And then, you know, obviously with the injuries in college, was that a concern people had with him coming out?
Yeah, he was right up there with the other two, Elway and Marino. Marino was the fastest and probably remains the fastest gun in the West. A shootout between he and Brett Favre would be interesting. Nobody else but those two has a quicker release. And Marino's arm strength, well, Favre's was too. That would be a a good workout comparison. Maybe someone should have done a reality show on that when they were at the peak of their careers. Elway was, you know, in those days, the best run-pass combination in football history, probably collegiate football history. And, of course, a better-than-average outfielder. He actually signed with the New York Yankees and played minor league ball for a year or two in the New York Penn League. So Jim was among that group. He was right there. The injury is what knocked him down. A shoulder injury in those days to a quarterback was always worrisome, going right through until the famous Drew Brees physical examination in Miami when he was a free agent, and they rejected him. And, of course, he went on to lead the Saints to the Super Bowl and a phenomenal career. But in Jim's day, it was really concerning. And in addition to which, the Bills doctor was an iconoclast, to say the least. That's probably putting it charitably. He was a law unto himself. And so it was almost impossible to have a conversation with him about a player if he made up his mind. And he apparently, you know, was in a position where he thought that Kelly would make it, but, you know, don't trade up, don't do anything like that. He did pass him. And so as the draft went on, Jim slipped because of the the shoulder injury, and the Bills were able to get him. And that turned out to be probably the best pick in the history of the franchise, made by Norm Pollum, who was then the personnel director.
You also got to wonder, what was in the water in the Pittsburgh area?
Yeah,
I mean, obviously, very, very famous for producing quarterbacks. But, I mean, in that era, you had Marino, you had Jim Kelly, you had, you know, Joe Montana up the road. I mean, it's just unbelievable, the sheer volume of great quarterbacks that, you know, came out of there. And then a generation before, Unitas, you had your Broadway Joe.
Ted Marchibroda.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. George Blanda.
George Blanda, yes. Yeah.
Rich Gannon.
Well, you know, as you know, it's a hotbed of, and still is a hotbed of high school and lower level, you know, even junior high and Pop Warner football. And while those lower levels have slipped and some population has left the area, it still remains one of the hotbeds of football in America.
It's the pride of Beaver Falls.
It's yeah, exactly, and those are places that I know it was true in Northeast Ohio too. You'd go to not a championship, because I went to them. You'd go to a Friday night high school football game, and there'd be 30,000 people. I mean, it was like the NFL, and they were playing wide open pro style offenses where guys were thrown for in high school for 300 yards a game.
Well, that's true in Texas today. That was true in Ohio at the time with Tiger Ellison and the run and shoot, which eventually found its way into college and the NFL.
And so anyway, a little more orientation. We have to remember that at this time, players got drafted twice and they had a choice because they were both being drafted into the NFL and into the USFL. Heading into the NFL draft, Jim let it be known that he did not want to play in a city with cold weather. and therefore wanted nothing to do with Buffalo, Minnesota, or Green Bay. I guess Chicago, too, at that point. But despite his wishes, he would be selected 14th in the 1983 NFL draft by the Buffalo Bills. And in a strange coincidence, 163 in the USFL draft to the Chicago Blitz, which at that point were run by the father and son team of George and Bruce Allen, where you would subsequently wind up as the de facto GM, Bill. So, what was the draft strategy in the USFL that was different than the NFL? Meaning, you know, were they looking for a different type of player? Were they looking for guys they thought they could get just by putting on more money? What was the calculus behind making a pick in those days?
It was a very, very ingenious system put together largely by Peter Hadhazy, who had come over from the NFL. Peter was the NFL's director of player personnel, came over to do the same job for in the league office with the USFL. And he came up with the idea of territorial picks so that each team in the USFL got the perpetual rights to any players from upwards of 5 to 7 schools in their geographic area. So, for example, with the Chicago Blitz, it was Notre Dame, Illinois, Indiana. I can't remember who the other two schools were right off the top of my head, but they were good, solid schools producing lots of players. The reason behind that was that the Peter and the powers that be in the USFL thought that it would be easier to sign those players and they would be recognizable to the fans who had followed them in college, and it turned out to be true. In addition, in order to avoid internecine fights, they gave the rights to players who were otherwise not spoken for territorially. For players in the NFL, they gave those to teams. So for the Chicago Blitz, for example, had the rights to the Chicago Bears, the St. Louis Cardinals, the Green Bay Packers, etc. Any player cut from any of those teams not otherwise spoken for by territorial collegiate rights belonged to the USFL team whose rights they held. And so what it did was give the USFL an immediate infusion of talent without having a war among each other, because the larger picture was to have the war with the NFL for the top draft choices, which was obviously going to be the biggest draw for television. So the USFL, when it came to first and second round guys who were, you know, first and second round NFL draft choices, they were very, very amenable to allowing a player to play where he wanted to play, as opposed to any rights agreement that would otherwise exist. And oddly enough, in the case of Doug Flutie, that played right into the hands of Donald Trump, who already had Brian Sipe at quarterback, but he scoffed up Doug Flutie despite the fact that the Chicago Blitz had drafted him and signed him. Right. Tough luck, Chicago Blitz, right? I was on the receiving end of that one. And as you can tell, I still remember it.
Yes, and expressed your feelings fairly vociferously at that point in time.
I did, I did.
And anyhow, even though this opportunity to eventually go to the Gamblers was there, the story is, Bill, see if you can confirm this for us, that Jim and his agents actually came very close to signing with Buffalo in 83. They were actually in the office, as I hear the story, ready to sign when a call came in from Bruce Allen. Is that true? And tell us about that, if it is.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They were in. I mentioned Pat McGroeder, a wonderful man, in a previous episode. Pat was Ralph Wilson's representative in Buffalo. Pat was a Buffalonian by birth and lived there all his life, leading citizen, very instrumental in bringing the ball, the Bills to Buffalo originally. And so he was the number one guy in Buffalo, with the Bills. They were in Pat's office going through the formality of signing the contract when across the hall, the phone rang, and, administrative assistant picked it up, and it was a call for Jim Kelly. And she came into the room and said, "Jim Kelly, there's a call for you. Would you like to take it?" And he said, "Yes." And on the line was Bruce Allen, who was then general manager of the Chicago Blitz. And Bruce said, "Don't sign that contract. We will give you a much better offer. Leave there. Come over to see me, and we'll discuss it." So Jim met with his agents. They excused themselves. They said they had some other things to do. They weren't quite ready to sign. Left the building. It seemed at times never to return, but they went over to Chicago, met with Bruce Allen, and Bruce said to him, you can determine where you want to play, and we'll give you a contract that's at least 50% better than what Buffalo was offering. And so Jim decided to play in Houston for the Houston Gamblers, owned by a doctor whose name I believe was Galetka, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong on that.
I think it's – wasn't that Jerry Argovitz?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Jerry Argovitz. That's right. I'm sorry. Pardon me.
Yeah, because first of all, I was going to say, I hope as a package deal – Jim at least brought along that administrative assistant after they fired her the next day for putting the call through.
Right. Well, they didn't. The fact is they didn't. She actually retired on my watch, and deservedly so. She was a very wonderful individual and just was doing her job. She's been I won't mention the name because she's been maligned enough during her lifetime, but she was a very lovely lady and as I said, retired while I was there.
Hey, I blame Bruce Allen. This is what we do in DC. It's totally fair game. We could just blame Bruce Allen for that whole situation. His fault.
Bill, do you remember this? There was a funny story when he went down to Houston. The money was there. They did. They gave him everything he wanted, but Dr. Argovitz, who was a dentist, who I guess somehow fancied himself a football player himself. Do you know that story about him working out with Jim Kelly?
I've heard it, not in detail.
Yeah, I mean, so what they said was Argovitz wanted to know, and I don't know whether it was the shoulder or what was going on, but was Kelly really all they stacked up to be? So he says here. Throw me some passes. So, of course, Elway's looking at this older dentist, and he's lobbing him in there. And he goes, no, you know, throw it to him. And he takes off running, and Jim throws a ball, which, like, breaks two of his fingers. And instead of saying, "What did you do to me?" he goes, You're hired. So, you know, there are many circuitous routes to success. You know, given the fact that you and Marv would take over that franchise, I know the whole USFL thing and the movement of players and Flutie and everything was problematic. How was that a huge regret? Was that something you just kind of shrugged your shoulders at when you got there? And you would have had Jim Kelly in Chicago had they, you know, not finagled things. How did you feel about it?
Well, no, Jim was never going to go to Chicago. He had no intention of playing in cold weather. So Bruce was just recruiting on behalf of the USFL, and Jim chose to go to Houston where it was warm and where he, you know, he felt like he'd be happiest. And we actually ended up playing against him twice. They were in our division when I was in the USFL with Marv and the Chicago Blitz. And the first time was down in Houston, and we had Doug Plank, who was a former Bear, legendary Bear, playing safety for us, And Doug was a ferocious, ferocious hitter. As a matter of fact, his number 46 is how Buddy Ryan named the 46 defense, because everything was keyed around his ability to blitz. So we dialed up some. Charlie Army was our defensive coordinator, who later became the general manager of the St. Louis Rams. And we dialed up some blitzes. And in the second quarter, I believe, of the game, we dialed up a blitz that freed Doug to be a free runner at Jim Kelly. And, of course, it was Kelly and the Smurfs. They had all these – it was the run-and-shoot offense, and they had all these little Smurf receivers, 5'10", 5'11", who were quicker than hiccups. They could run and catch, but they were little guys. And it was a brand new offense. You know, people didn't really know how to defense it. And when you face that, people spread out. You know, the general rule is blitz them. So we had this blitz dialed up for Doug. And in those days, Marv did not wear a headset. I wore the headset and stood next to him on the sideline and relayed the messages down from the press box, particularly the down and distance when we got into short yardage and goal line, which Marv controlled and scripted. So Doug comes on this blitz, and the hit would be suspendable today. In fact, it would be a multi-game suspension. But he lowered his head and hit Jim right in the chin with the top of his helmet. Boom. I mean, you could hear the blow, and blood came flying out of Jim's chin, and it knocked him backwards like a fighter. His feet were still on the ground, and his torso and arm and head were going backwards with the tremendous force that Doug had delivered. And on his way back, he threw about a 50-yard strike to one of the Smurfs downfield for what amounted to a sure touchdown. And Marv and I stood there and looked at one another, and we both said at the same time, "Holy bleep!"
Yep.
How did he do that?
Right.
So then they beat us in that game, and then in the second game — that game was in Houston, the second game was in Chicago on St. Patrick's Day, of all days, in a blizzard, which was about, I don't know, 19 or so inches. It even canceled the St. Patrick's Day parade in Chicago, if you can believe that. It did. And there might have been 17 people in Soldier Field for that game. But Jim put on a show that day in a blizzard. So when we got to Buffalo and teamed up, there was no question that we were Jim Kelly fans. That's for sure, because we'd seen it up close and personal.
That's what I was going to ask you. So, you know, when this serendipitous stuff happened, and you first get to Buffalo, and then, as we'll talk about next week, Marv gets there, you know, here's this guy that you have the rights to, who, you know, you think he's changing suits in a phone booth, right? I mean, that I mean, so I know how much they wanted him from a publicity standpoint, but you must have been yourself just so eager to sign the guy. I mean, because what you've seen, and he, right? I mean, that must have been, you know, one of the guys if you were going to pick out of the entire USFL or the college draft, why not go with Jim Kelly as your quarterback, right?
Well, yeah, not only that, but prior to the dissolution of the USFL, and even when I was the pro guy in Buffalo and Terry Bledsoe was the GM, and then Terry got sick, as we explained in last week's episode, and I was more acting as a sort of a junior decision maker, if you will, we got numerous calls from teams around the NFL looking to trade for Jim's rights. And as I mentioned, we were bereft of talent. We needed an infusion of talent. And so on two occasions, I went to Mr. Wilson and gave him offers that had come to me via people in the NFL. The first was from Al Davis, who said, I'll give you any 10 players on our team for the rights to Jim Kelly. And so I told Mr. Wilson, and he said, oh, Al's bluffing. He knew Al very, very well. And he said, but Carla, who do you want? So I named Howie Long and, you know, you name it, every star right. that they had, right?
Yeah.
And he said, well, call him back and see what he has to say. So I called him back. I said, for us to consider it, Mr. Davis, this is what we'd have to have. Boom, 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 boom. So he said, I'll call you back. I'm still waiting for the call.
Yeah.
And by the way, Al and I became pretty good acquaintances, you might say, over the years, and he never brought it up again, nor did I. But then we got an offer from the Houston Oilers, and they offered their starting quarterback about four starters and two ones and two twos for the rights to Jim. And I believe that quarterback was Jim Everett.
Ah.
So I took it to Mr. Wilson. I'd scouted Jim and Rod Woodson. They were on the same team at Purdue. So I took it to Mr. Wilson and Norm and I believe Kay Stevenson were in the meeting as well. And I explained to him that, you know, this was probably as good an offer as we're going to get. And that we all felt that while Everett wasn't Jim Kelly, you could win with Chris Everett. And certainly.
Or Jim. Not to pull the Jim Rome.
Yeah, of course. Yes, yes. Famously.
Exactly. I got to say, that was one of my favorite moments in television history when he called him Chris Everett for the third time and he knocked his ass on the ground with the desk and the chair on top of him. So
who doesn't want that guy after that? I mean, come on. Everybody's wanted to do that to Jim Rome.
So Mr. Wilson made, I think he'd already made the decision, but he enunciated it. And it, I've said numerous times, changed the course of NFL history and certainly Bill's history. He said, no, I am not going to trade the rights to Jim Kelly. We're not going to lose him twice. And so all three of us at one point or another said during the conversation, Mr. Wilson, this is going to cost a lot of money. And he said, I know. But we're not going to trade the rights to Jim Kelly. I don't want to hear about any more of these offers. We're going to sign Jim Kelly. And so I inquired. I said, Mr. Wilson, do you really think that the USFL is going to fold, that he'll be available? He said, yes, I do. I do. He's going to be available. And when he's available, we're going to sign him. It's okay. So within probably a year or a little more, that situation came about.
Just kind of circling back to that, just in terms of other options. I mean, obviously you had gotten in the Bruce Smith draft, Frank Reich and Andre Reed. Was there ever a point where you thought, okay, if we did move on from Jim in the trade process, that Frank could be kind of a long-term starter for you guys? Or did you sort of know, okay, he's going to fill a very crucial role as a backup for us?
No. We felt that Frank had the capability to be a starter and a good one. He did not have the overarching ability that Jim had. You know, Jim's it's ironic. It turned out that Jim was the quarterback that was destined to play in Buffalo. God created him to play in Buffalo. You know, tough as nails, Western Pennsylvania tough. Kelly tough, physically, mentally, emotionally, could play, had an arm that was second to none, could play in any kind of weather, mixed it up with anybody at any time, typified the blue collar mentality of Buffalo, the tough mentality of Buffalo. And most importantly of all, as good a long passer as ever existed in the game. I've never seen a more accurate long passer than Jim Kelly. I mean, he literally could drop it in the barrel 10 out of 10 times at 60 yards. And so his talent and his persona and the fit was so Buffalo that, you know, you said to yourself, hey, Frank's great, and we can win with Frank, but if you got a chance to get Jim Kelly, that's a different ballgame.
Right. Well, I mean, and also, like, the state of the state. I mean, let's kind of, before we get into kind of the negotiation piece of this and actually how Jim came to Buffalo, I mean, the state of the state in 86, you know, you're a new GM, as we talked about last week. People were, you know, Bill who? And then, you know, what was public perception like around the team? I mean, they had lost Jim in 83. Obviously, things had been compounded by Joe Cribbs. You know, how vital was getting Jim to Buffalo from a fan perspective, from a ticket perspective? You know, and how much pressure did you feel on that as this new young GM?
Well, it's a great question. And it requires a little more explanation than just what you asked. You have to in order to understand the context, you have to understand the place the Bills hold in Western New York. The hockey team is great, and at that time they were still having a good run with the French Connection and Scotty Bowman and, you know, all that. But they're by far second fiddle to the Bills. The Bills are Buffalo's number one attraction 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And because of the nationwide prominence, preeminence of the NFL, the Bills were Buffalo's signature to the rest of the country. And in the 70s, the steel industry had collapsed. The late 70s, the steel industry had collapsed, and Buffalo lost over 200,000 jobs, probably close to 250,000 people in population who had moved elsewhere, who we would meet and greet at road games during our our great years.
Right.
The blizzard of 77 was, you know, notorious. It was a story around the country. 83 comes along and we don't sign Jim. He's literally in the office, not with pen in hand, but in the office, and is spirited out by Bruce Allen and rejects the Bills and signs with Houston. That metaphor was not lost on sports writers all around the country. The old dying Rust Belt city loses the great future quarterback to the oil-rich Sun Belt rising star Houston. That was the story. And it was baked into the mentality in Buffalo. And so the number one attraction, Buffalo's number one ambassador to the wider world, if you will, is down and out. And there was a pall over the franchise. I've said it 100 times. I said it then. I'll repeat it now. There was a black cloud over the franchise. So much so that when a local family, the Rich family, who owned Rich Products, which is a dairy-producing industry, brought AAA baseball back to Buffalo, the city built them a marvelous stadium downtown. And when I first joined the Bills, it was not uncommon to see kids walking around with Buffalo Bisons hats on and Buffalo Bisons T-shirts on and not Bills stuff. It drove me crazy. Right. It was one of the first marketing moves myself and our assistant GM, Bill Munson, made when we took over to try and just, in today's jargon, and say revive the brand. We made over 200 speaking engagements between us the first winter we were there, simply because the Bills were just considered the lowest of the low and a laughing stock. And as a matter of fact, after the second 2-14 season, Larry Feltzer, who was the longtime columnist in the Buffalo Evening News, it was a one newspaper city at that point in time, and the news was the preeminent media vehicle. The television stations were distant second fiddle to the Buffalo News in terms of opinion making and things of that nature. Larry Feltzer wrote, "Let them leave. The Buffalo's better off without the Bills." So that was the context, the milieu that existed in Buffalo when it became apparent that Jim's rights belonged to us and that he was going to be free of his USFL obligations.
So at that point, it seriously comes to the fore. You got to sign Jim Kelly. So you had a couple problems to overcome. There's still, even though, as you pointed out, he was truly perfectly situated to play in this very difficult, trying, freezing, snowy climate because he was so tough. You know, he was still saying, you know, up until that time, he didn't want to play, you know, in a northern city. So when you went to him and started to talk to him, was it as much of a sales pitch about why come to Buffalo, why it's a good place to be, as it was just about what the dollars would be? I mean, did you really have to be a salesman?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, there were some contretemps before that cropped up. Along about January 1, I guess it was 86, Pete Rozelle sent out a memo saying that there's to be no contact with anybody who's under contract to the USFL until his office specifically approved it. And that includes everybody in the employ of a club. So
this would have been after the Pyrrhic victory in the lawsuit, where the USFL won the case against the NFL, was awarded $1, which was trebled to $3, but it became apparent that Trump's idea of moving to the fall and the financial capacity of the league was such that it was going to collapse, right? But it still had players under contract to the individual teams.
Yeah, that's correct. Most of our scouts and football people were out at all-star games then, East-West, Senior Bowl, etc. I simply photocopied Commissioner Rozelle's letter and sent it out with a cover letter from me. No one is to make any contact with any agent about anything to do with a USFL player under pain of forfeiture of your job, period. Jim Valek, who I mentioned before, was sort of Hank Bulla's football guy. He was at the East-West game, and it got back to me almost immediately through the media, because I guess the agents told people about it, that he had met with Lustig and Fagan, who were Jim Kelly's agents, somewhere in the San Francisco area. So I called and inquired of it, and he said, yes, he did, because he knew the Raiders had met with them, and he wanted to get our oar in the water. So unfortunately, you know, I had to keep my promise, and we parted company. We reported what amounted to a bump-in, I guess. Valek had come up through the college ranks, and so bump-ins at the college level were commonplace. In his defense, I'm sure he thought this was nothing more than that. I reported it to the league office and to Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson was furious. And so we just sort of sat on it at that point. But we also knew and weren't a bit surprised by the fact that the Raiders had approached him because they had approached us about a trade.
Right. And just so everyone's clear, when Bill says a bump in, that was a contrived mechanism where somebody from one of the leagues would just show up at the same restaurant where the kid was eating or be walking down, or happen to walk down the street where his parents lived. And holy moly, they happened to run into the guy.
Surprise!
Right? Unbelievable. So, all right.
Big surprise.
So, you know, so Jim Valek, in trying to be a good soldier, sadly, you know, had to be let go because you had to live up to your word. So take us back just one step again. So, you know, there had been these offer of these trades, some of which really could have been fantastic. Ralph Wilson says no trade. And does he basically say to you, we have to get Jim Kelly whatever it takes? So if he used those words or sort of whatever cost, in your mind, how high is whatever cost?
Well, Mr. Wilson said, we're going to sign Jim Kelly, period. So that was an order, not a suggestion.
Right.
Secondly, when players, there was a period, a negotiation period, where the NFL and what the remnants of the USFL reached agreement on a window where players who were under contract to the USFL could be spoken to by the teams that owned their rights in the NFL. And so when that came about, which was in the summer of that year, I spoke to Mr. Wilson and said, look, this is going to be the biggest contract in football because this is the biggest star and he knows he's got us over a barrel. He's got all the leverage. And we don't know what other people have offered him. We know that there are people out there offering. I'll find out, I guess, when we speak to him. And so Mr. Wilson said, yes, I know. Make it, try and get it as cheaply as you can, but we got to get him. So, okay. So that was that. As I say, in the summer, the interregnum took place where you could speak with people. And so I set up a meeting in New York with Jim and his agents.
That's the famous Helmsley Palace tete-a-tete, correct?
Yes, yes. Opposite St. Patrick's Cathedral, by the way,
exactly.
On Madison Avenue and 50th Street.
Where you spent the morning prior to the meeting.
Well, not the morning, but I did go in and, as Catholics say, make a visit and say a prayer.
Right. So, you and I have talked about this in the past, but I'd like our listeners to understand Bill Polian is somebody who thinks everything through. You did not walk into that meeting ready to shoot from the hip. Tell our listeners about all the preparation, the thought that you had put together about this pitch to sell Kelly and the agents on Buffalo, all the different parts of it, you know, and how you thought it through and the research and everything like that. So when you walked through the door, you were in the position to make a hard sell. Tell us about that.
Well, I had to prepare as you do for any negotiation or any meeting of any kind. And so you always try to put yourself in the shoes of the person that you're appealing to. And in Jim's case, I knew full well what his objections were. I knew full well that he had an offer on the table. We assumed it was from the Raiders. I knew full well that he did not want to play in Buffalo necessarily. And so I thought, well, this is not the time to aim this at the agents. I'm recruiting a college or high school player. He's just 6 years older and a lot wiser than the college players that I used to recruit. So I tailored my pitch as follows. Jim, you know, we've never met before, but I'm a football guy. Here's my background. We're not dissimilar personalities. I was born about 120 blocks from here and you know, grew up streetwise, as most New Yorkers are, especially those that come from the so-called outer boroughs, of which the Bronx is one. And so I'm here to talk football with you. When it comes time to talk money, I'll talk money, but I'm here to talk football. And I want you to know why I think Buffalo is the best place for you. So I went through all the moves we've made, Frank Reich, Andre Reed, et cetera, et cetera. Hank Bull is a defensive coach. He's going to help in terms of getting you with a defense that can that can win. We have Daryl Talley. We have Bruce Smith, et cetera. We traded for Pete Metzelaars, anticipating that you were going to come. Every move we've made anticipated that you were going to come. We didn't know for sure, but I was unwilling to go along with any moves that wouldn't fit with you, what your talent is and what our vision for you is. So that was the football discussion. The second part of it was, look it, you can go to Oakland and you'll be another in the long line of Raider quarterbacks, albeit maybe the best one. You'll be playing in the shadow of Al Davis. They might have been in Los Angeles at the time. I can't remember, but it's certainly on the West Coast. But it's Al Davis's team. If you come to Buffalo, this is Jim Kelly's team. Ralph Wilson owns it, but it's Jim Kelly's team. You will be the biggest thing that's happened to Buffalo sports since the Bills came here. And that's a pretty nice place to be. You're going to make more of a contribution to this city and the Western New York area than you ever dreamed of or could ever make in La La Land. You're going to be the man, period. And there's something to be said for that. And third, we recognize that you know, you're going to need to be paid. There's no question about that. Now, I'm going to negotiate hard, and we're going to do what we think is appropriate and prudent for the franchise. But don't think that anybody's going to try and lowball you here. That's not the case. So he said, whether he allowed me to finish or not, I can't remember it. But at some point he said, look, I respect everything you're saying. And it's you're clearly a football guy. I mean, I got out, we X'd and O's, I put some diagrams up and things like that. And he said, I really appreciate that. And that's very different from the last time I was in Buffalo. But he said, I just don't want to play there. And I said, all right, look, I understand. I think this was the first time that I mentioned the Raiders. I said, I understand that you got the Raider offer. I mean, we're big boys here. I'm not running down to the league office and hollering tampering. I understand that there's an offer out there. But you need to understand, Jim, I'm this is my first and only shot to be a GM. And if we let you walk to another team in the NFL via trade, my career is over. And I got four kids. So very selfishly, I can't allow that to happen. So if you say I'm not coming, then you're correct. We do have to trade you. But it will be to Green Bay. I mean, I guarantee you, if it's for a bag of footballs, it will be to Green Bay.
What about towels?
Well, I hadn't thought of towels, but now that you mention it, you're right.
you've needed some towels before.
Right. Socks and jocks.
So I said, I just can't allow some other franchise to come in here and steal Jim Kelly twice. In a certain ironic sense, we're welded together in this thing, because my career's attached to yours in large measure. You have to understand, you know, we're both Irish guys, right? I'm not going to let somebody pick my pocket. So he laughed and said, okay.
I want to get the sense of the human dynamic, because while you're going through this, and you obviously said the right things, pushed the right buttons, had enough bravado that he should respect you. You must have been churning inside, because all this guy has to do is say no, and you really didn't have a career anymore. So what was going on inside Bill Polian while you were making this great spiel?
Well, nothing, because it wasn't the spiel. It was all true. I was expressing my true feelings. This is how we see things. This is what I believe you can do for this franchise. This is what I believe the franchise can do for you. This is what you can do for the area. And the fact that somebody else is out there making you an offer doesn't mean jack to me, because I'm not going to let that happen. So it's the best kind of sales pitch, a true one.
Right, exactly. So I guess I should have asked the question a different way. Were you pretty confident? Now, you hadn't gotten into the money yet, but were you pretty confident that that was a winning sales pitch and you would ultimately prevail? That's the question I should ask.
Yes, and I was confident almost from when we got into the meat of the conversation. We hit it off. I mean, it was pretty clear. There was chemistry there. You know, you can tell when you connect with a person on a human basis. And we did. And he did. He was very gracious. He said, listen, I don't doubt that you're a good football guy. You made that pretty clear. And that's different than what I saw in Buffalo last time around. So we clicked right from the outset. And that's still true today.
So the next step was you went to Houston and you negotiated with Greg Lustig. What kind of negotiator was he? Describe the sort of the tenor of the negotiations. Were there key back and forth issues that got traded off? And also, how closely did they push you to the limit of what you were willing to pay? So just give us all that.
Well, there's a funny story that leads it off. I got back to Buffalo and reported to Mr. Wilson and told him what the conversation was about. And Jim had said at the end of the meeting in New York, well, all right, listen, you probably need to get together with Lustig and Fagan and see if we can't reach agreement. So naturally, you know, I didn't need an airplane to fly home. The fact that he'd given us the go-ahead to go try and reach agreement was a victory in and of itself, and or was certainly the first step down that road. And so when I reported to Mr. Wilson, we talked about what the issues were and what the finances would be. And as it turned out, we were going to play in Houston the following weekend in a preseason game. And Arch Leister was our quarterback. Was going to be the quarterback for that game, by the way. An odd, sad irony. And so the stars sort of aligned. And because Jim was still living in Houston. And so naturally, when I got back, I can't remember if I said anything to the media. I think we may have issued a statement. But it was pretty clear that we're now at the 11th hour, you know, we're going to get him or not get him. And so I think I was headed for Houston on Wednesday afternoon. And So I may have gone out to dinner with, I know we went out to dinner with some friends, on maybe on Tuesday, and they said to me at dinner, how does it feel to have your career flashing before your eyes?
Right, right.
As friends often will.
Yes.
So that was really the first time I'd thought about it. You know, I was immersed in all the other details of it. So then I get to the airport, and of course, security was nowhere near what it is today. And so when I got to the gate, there were a group of school children from a Catholic school up in North Buffalo, at the gate. There may be a half dozen or so, and a couple of adults. And they said, "Mr. Polian, we want to give you this prayer card with our best wishes. We're praying for you to sign Jim Kelly." And I thanked them very much and got on the plane, and I said, only in Buffalo could this happen. Yeah, right.
You have the class outing to give you the prayer card.
Yeah, and I don't say that in any denigrating way. I say it in the kindest, most loving way. I mean, sure. Buffalo's a special, special place, and sure. It shows you the tremendous place that the Bills hold in the heart of Buffalo. Just as an example, Mr. Wilson lived in Detroit, and so I was sort of the highest ranking official when I became GM of the Bills, because Pat McGroeder unfortunately had passed away, and so when the governor would come for a luncheon or something like that, I was always expected to be there. When the lieutenant governor of Canada came, I was expected to be there. When the Irish ambassador came, I was expected to be there. You know, it opened up a whole new world to me that I had that I'd only seen from afar. But you know, the county executive was our landlord, and I had to meet with him fairly frequently, and the mayor, and so on. So it's a special place. If you're a Bill, is the point. So off we went to Houston. Dave Olson met me down there, our treasurer. We discussed what we thought the parameters would be. We figured that the ceiling was $1 million a year for however many years. I can't recall. I think it was 5 years. And that would have been the largest contract at the time in the history of the NFL.
Are you talking paragraph five, or is that with incentives?
Everything, with all things considered, you know, how we structured it was almost immaterial. The money was so large that it wasn't going to matter anyway. and so I think on Thursday we got together with Lustig and Fagan and just talked generally. A.J. Fagan was the bad cop. Greg Lustig was the good cop. And it was two on one. Dave didn't participate in the meetings. And later on, when George Young, the late great general manager of the Giants, he asked me to replay what happened, and I told him it was Lustig and Fagan against me, and he became apoplectic. He said, "What's wrong with you? Never negotiate two on one. You should have thrown Fagan out of the hotel." I said, "George, you're right." I just wasn't smart enough to figure it out. So we negotiated generally the first day. The second day, we went into some specifics, which would have been Friday, I believe. We went into some specifics. And during that meeting, Fagan began to try to and did get under my skin. And this is the real story. This has turned into a fish story over time. So I'll give the real story here. He kept saying, and he had a very whiny voice, and he was about 5'7", and if he weighed 150 pounds, that was a lot. So, I mean, he'd never played football or been around football in any way, maybe a manager or something, but he certainly didn't know anything about football technique. And he said to me, "Oh, you have a lousy offensive line. They can't pass protect. Jim will get hurt again. It'll end his career." And it kept coming back. You don't have any receivers. I said, no, we got Pete Metzler, Andre Reed, Jerry. Jerry's last name is escaping me now from Clemson. Really good receiver. Jerry Butler. Really good receiver. I said, we have good receivers. What the heck are you talking about? So he kept harping on this. And every time we'd make some progress, he'd come back in with one of these nudges, you know, denigrating statements. So he kept harping on the offensive line, offensive line, offensive line. And I said to him, okay, if you know so damn much about offensive line play, and he was seated in a chair next to the picture window in the Hyatt Hotel in downtown Houston on about the 25th floor. So it had a view of downtown. He was next to the window, and I was across the room. So I got up and walked over, and I said, if you know so much about offensive line play, stand up and show me how you would block a defense, how you would attack an offensive play, tackle who's short set. And he kind of sat there. I said, no, come on. If you're such an expert on offensive line, come on, show me. And he just sat there. Sort of said, Lustig then came over and said, no, stop, Bill. It's no, we're not getting anywhere here. So I didn't throw him out of the window.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how close was he going through the glass?
I didn't grab him by the throat or the shoulders or any other such nonsense, which has been out there in the ether ever since.
Right.
But would you call it a confrontation? Probably. Technically, yes. I certainly didn't physically threaten him in any way. If he had been a football person, he would have stood up and said, yeah, all right, look, and gone into a demonstration of something. So it was really more a football clinic talk than anything else. But the point I wanted to make was that he couldn't do it. And clearly I did. So, things got a little more testier after that, because I think Fagan was trying. Lustig was trying to stick up for him, so it got to the point where we were ended up hollering at each other, and so we took a break. We had I forget where they were in their suite. I think they had adjoining rooms or something like that. They weren't in staying in the same room. We're just using this room to negotiate. We took a break and they went and called Jim and Jim came over and said to me what happened. And I explained it to him. And he said to them in full view of me, knock it off. You know, I don't want, this is not the way we should be doing business. And he turned to me and said, and you take it easy, you know, this is a negotiation. It's not a fight. And I said, okay, fair enough. So, we broke it off that evening and went into the next day and the whole tenor had changed, but the next day was the game day. So, or maybe Friday night was the game. That may have been it. Friday night may have been the game. It's a detail. Doesn't matter. Jim sat with Mr. Wilson during the game. And I don't know that this has ever been publicized enough. Mr. Wilson, as only he could, if he wanted to, did a phenomenal sales job on Jim. And he backed up everything that I had said to Jim. And Jim has said many times that Mr. Wilson was the guy that convinced him to come to Buffalo because, after all, he was the guy who was calling the shots. I was just an employee. And Mr. Wilson did a phenomenal job recruiting Jim. And so Jim, I think, made up his mind at that point that he was coming. So we went back the next day and it was clear that we were going to get it done. It was only Dave was in the meeting at that point in time, and they were talking about cash flow and things of that nature. So I excused myself, and I went back, and I called Bill Munson, my assistant GM, who was as good as there is in the world, just retired from the Bills about 3 or 4 years ago. And I said to him, it looks like this is going to get done. You better prepare for a press conference. So do whatever you need to do to make sure that, you know, we're able to do this in a dignified way. And, you know, you better make sure that we're going to come back private. I'm sure Mr. Wilson will send a plane. So you better make sure that we got enough security at the airport that we don't have a, you know, a melee there. So he said, okay, I'm on it.
Yeah, you didn't want to get mugged by those Catholic girls.
No. So we finished up the details and had agreement, and the deal ended up around $1 million for 5 years, which is right where we thought it would be. And so I called months back. I called Mr. Wilson first and said it was done. He and Dave and I, and he got on the phone, and he was obviously very happy. And so I called months back and said, it's done. You know, lay on the press conference. And he said, well, look, at you're going to need to know these things. The press conference is not going to be here at Bill Stadium. It's going to be downtown at the Hilton Hotel in the Grand Ballroom. So I said, what? He said, yeah. He said, there's more press than you can shake a stick at. And he said, there'll be police escorts and Buffalo police at the airport to meet you, and they'll bring you directly to the Hilton. All I need to know is ETA. So I said, okay, I'll call you with an ETA when we're at the airport here in Houston. And so we're on the plane I'm really not dealing with Jim too much. I'm dealing with all these details. And so we're on the plane coming to Buffalo, or getting ready to go to Buffalo. And I said to Jim, you're not going to believe what you see when you get here. So this is, at least from what I'm hearing, as big as when the president comes to Buffalo. And I don't know that he's come since McKinley, maybe JFK, but
he shot him.
It's, yeah, it's as you know, you've never seen anything like this in your life. And he kind of laughed and said, "Ah, come on." I said, "I'm telling you, you're not going to believe this." So the private part of the airport at Buffalo is sequestered a little bit. And the general public can't get there, but obviously media can. So, as we circled to land, the pilot said, look down, you'll see quite a gathering. So there had to be at minimum 15 police cars with the lights flashing. There were a couple of limos. There was a press pool that looked in size similar to that which the gaggle that you see on the White House lawn, you know, maybe 20, 25 with cameras and what have you. And so Jim said, "Woo, look at that." I said, "Yeah, you better compose something to say." He said, "Well, what are you going to say?" And I gave him a couple of sentences. So we got off the plane, the shutters flashed, the cameras were rolling. We walked over to the cameras. We both made a brief statement and got into the cars. And now there's this line of police cars, sheriff's departments from all over Western New York, Buffalo PD, Lancaster PD. It was a motorcade, the likes of which I've never been involved with before. And so we got in the car and and now we drove away from the airport. And to get into downtown Buffalo, you have to go down a four-lane highway, which is called Highway 33, and it has overpasses over it as you go down toward Buffalo. And so when we were just about to turn on 33, on either side of the car, people lined up on either side of the road, you know, with signs, "Welcome, Jim. Happy days are here again. Bill's flags." And now we get on to 33, and as we approached every overpass, there were people on top of the overpasses cheering with signs and flags and throwing confetti in it. And Jim looked at me and said, "Wow, you were right." So we arrived at the hotel, and the parking lot was jammed, and the ballroom was full to overflowing with dignitaries and sponsors and seated in rows, just like you see in the Rose Garden. And it was an indoor ballroom, a raised dais. Mr. Wilson was there. Hank Buller, our coach, was there. The mayor, the county executive, everybody welcoming Jim back to Buffalo. And it was just the darndest thing you've ever seen. And that hotel happens to be on the Buffalo waterfront, which is a beautiful, beautiful setting. And so we took a picture, Jim and I did, holding up the number 12 jersey side by side with the waterfront in the background. And he signed one to me, obviously, signed one to lots of members of my family. And my mother had it hanging in her apartment until the day she died, next to the Pope and John Kennedy.
It's pretty good company.
Yeah, well, that's where Jim Kelly belongs, in the hierarchy of Buffalo Bills football.
And of great Irishmen.
Yeah, that's right. That was the first real momentous day in the change in fortunes for the Buffalo Bills. And I've often said that day, this actually happened. It was a cloudy day when we landed. And by the time we went outside to take the picture, the clouds had parted and the sun was out. It was pretty close to, late in the afternoon. Oh, the other thing that I'd forgotten was, in those days, the evening news used to be on from 6:30 to 7, Huntley Brinkley, network news.
Right.
It was preempted in Buffalo for the press conference.
Well, because they also had to mention that it was no longer cloudy.
Well, that's right. And when we went outside, amazingly and ironically, the clouds had gone and the sun was shining. And so, I've used that description ever since. When Jim Kelly came back, the cloud that was hanging over the Buffalo Bills lifted and the sun shone brightly from there on in.
That's great. That's great.
Very cool one today, guys. Well, next week, I think we're going to fully cement that sunny days are here for quite some time as we hit the third prong of building the Bills with Marv Levy's arrival in Buffalo. And kind of with that, Rick, why don't you throw us into the audible this week?
Okay. So, Bill, we've done this in real life, so to speak, and occasionally on the show. When we talk about comparables. So when you look at the kind of quarterback, that Jim turned out to be in the NFL, either historically, before him or subsequently to him, who would be the closest comparison, at that position that you could identify?
Boy, that's hard. Mahomes is a little more active than Jim, but I think that's a pretty fair comparison. He's animated as a leader. He'll do what it takes. That's probably as close as I can come. I think Mahomes is probably a pretty good comparison.
Which would certainly reinforce everything everybody believes and bode well for the rest of Patrick Mahomes' career.
Yeah, I think Troy Aikman, although their temperaments were somewhat different, public persona was somewhat different, similar style. Troy was a very similar style. Marino was different in the sense that he had that lightning quick release, and wasn't quite as athletic as Jim. Jim was more athletic than people give him credit for. So Marino slightly different. Elway. I mean, they're all in the same. They're all in the same. I mean, those three, that holy trinity of quarterbacks that all now have gold jackets. Mm-hmm. All very similar.
Okay.
Well, and then for mine, I know we like to not do, we don't want to do hypotheticals on the show, so I'll avoid my urge to give the hypothetical of Bill's take of how an actual fist fight with AJ Fagan would have played out, even though I'm curious. I think I know. I have a sense. I have a pretty good sense how that goes, but we're going to avoid that one. And instead, we'll get into our week 5 in review. I guess you got to start this week with, if you got 4th and short on the 6-yard line in Seattle, do you kick the field goal to go up by 8, or do you go for it to try to end the game?
I have always been a proponent of taking the points, and I heard this from Paul Brown and reiterated by Mike Holmgren, probably 10 years apart, in the National Football League and professional football, always take the points.
Yeah, I think we've learned nothing else from this show. You do not want to give Russell Wilson the ball with the ability to beat you with any amount of time on the clock.
Yep. I know that the analytics people feel differently, always take the points.
But also, even the analytics didn't seem that logical last night in terms of, so like, you know, because NBC had their analytics up where there was like a 94% chance of winning the game at that point. For the Vikings, you go for it, your chances, and you get it obviously increased to 100. But if you miss it, it decreases by 15%, which still, even from a Vegas dice roll perspective, you've now given Russell Wilson a third of a chance of beating you where he had a minimal a chance going into it. It's just, even in that scenario, as much as they tried to sell it, the analytics didn't really make sense. Any other things we should take away from what we saw yesterday?
I think, you know, you saw the fact that it's hard for even really the best teams to play their best every Sunday because of injury, illness, fatigue, what have you. So, you know, the Raiders got into a shootout with Kansas City, and they were able to come out on top, and that'll happen. I'm not sure that it would happen 8 out of 10 times, but it did yesterday, which proves just how tough it is to win a game in the National Football League any given week. The other thing is that, what a sad, sad thing for Dak Prescott. I hope and pray that he makes a complete recovery and comes back. And, you know, Washington's quarterback is a prime example of that. He did. He made it back. So, I'm sure Dak will, but it also points out that running quarterbacks at some point or another get hurt. I mean, you got to really be careful about it. You take too many chances, sooner or later, Lady Luck's not going to smile on you.
Yeah, it also points out when you have the opportunity to sign a multi-year contract and the safety of that, especially if there's a guarantee. It's not something agents should walk by lightly.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely right. And you know, for the amount of money that's at risk these days, that's absolutely correct. And it's a sad thing. And I'm sure he'll get his money and he'll be back. I'm hoping and praying that he will, because he's good for the game. The other thing is that while we're talking about quarterbacks, the other quarterback in that game I thought played pretty well, who didn't play well, were the offensive tackles in the New York Giants. That's the reason that Jones had such a rough time. So, all we talk about is this quarterback didn't do this and this quarterback didn't do that. Well, no quarterback can play without protection. And that's that. It gets lost in the discussion because people discuss the obvious, but in that case, it's really not his fault. And they won't be, the Giants will not be a good football team until they solve that problem. Now, it's exacerbated, obviously, by injury and by retirement, but the fact of the matter is they got to get it solved.
Mm-hmm.
Very true. All right, gang. Well, that was a fun one today. As always, if you have questions for us in the Audible or anything you want to hear us address, please hit us up on Twitter at IFBillPolian, and we will be sure to include it in the show. And hey, we're on to Marv Levy next week. I cannot wait. Thank you again, guys, for an awesome show today.
Thank you, Scott. Stay safe and well, everybody.
Stay safe, everyone. Thank you.